Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, healthcare and science in the news, debate, discussion, dialogue. And coming up at the half hour, we'll have a little science lesson about cholera, which is actually a rather fascinating biological topic, as you'll see. And, of course, answers to your questions, emails. I'm going to ask the callers that we do have to wait for just a few moments while I talk about some interesting stuff in the news this week. This one I particularly liked because, as you know, I've become quite the advocate in the last few years for vitamin D supplementation. And this study just out looked at people who underwent lung transplants. Essentially what it found was that vitamin D deficiency was associated with an increase in transplant rejections in the first year after transplants. So there is a pretty significant improvement in the ability of people to basically tolerate a organ transplant, in the case of lung transplants anyway, if they have higher levels of vitamin D. And we're entering into the time of year when, at least at the 37th parallel where we find ourselves in Santa Cruz County, you don't make vitamin D in your skin. So even though the sun may be shining, you probably aren't getting strong enough or energetic enough photons to actually do the production. So you're living off your body's stores right now. Now, it is a fat-soluble vitamin, and that's a good thing. But nevertheless, it does run low in people. And in the last few years, I've been doing vitamin D levels in my patient population, and I found rather startlingly that more than half of the people I check are actually technically deficient, maybe not badly deficient, but presumably deficient enough that their immune systems may not be functioning optimally. They may be a little hyperreactive, not as obvious as a lung transplant situation, but definitely there's a place for supplementation. Another study worth mentioning just on the basis of the low-hanging fruit of prevention, this looking at how many people who should be taking aspirin for primary prevention of heart attack actually are doing it. Anyone with high cholesterol, anyone with hypertension, pretty much anybody, any male over the age of 50 who hasn't had an ulcer is probably a candidate for aspirin therapy. There's better data on males than females, but there's good data that it's also protective in women. When you actually look at patients, even those who have had a heart attack are quite a bit less likely than we'd like to be taking an aspirin a day, 70% as opposed to 100% of post-heart attack patients. And in those who are just at risk because they are over 50, male, high blood pressure, high lipids, the rates are down in the low 20%. So we as healthcare professionals need to do a much better job of promoting daily aspirin use for primary prevention of heart disease. That's one of the, as I said, low-hanging fruits out there that we need to be looking at. Another little FDA in the news, Darvon and Darvocet are going to be withdrawn by the FDA, rather at the FDA's request. These are long-standing painkillers that have been around for a very, very long time. The generic name for this is propoxypine. Over 10 million people used it last year, even though it's an extremely old drug and has been linked widely with problems with heart arrhythmias and sudden death. It was actually discontinued in Europe some time ago, and the United States is finally asking it to be withdrawn. Those patients who are on that for pain control are going to have to find something else. Fortunately, there are a large number of other pain control drugs. From the doctor's standpoint, since they changed the triplicate laws, it's really not a difference for us how we manage these prescriptions. So I think overall, it's a good thing. Any drug that has excess mortality, particularly causing instability in the heart rhythm, has to be looked at as a menace that should be withdrawn. And I also want to take a moment to applaud the steps that the FDA took this week to remove the alcoholic beverage plus caffeine sort of energy drinks with a little bit of alcohol in them. Very bad combination, by the way, folks, alcohol and caffeine, because they're both cardiac destabilizers. They tend to cause extra heartbeats, particularly errant heartbeats from non-pacemaker cells. And if one of those errant heartbeats pops up at just the right moment, it can flip the heart into a chaotic beat called ventricular fibrillation, which, if you aren't defibrillated promptly in the field, can lead to sudden death. So best we take those things out of circulation, both in terms of the public circulation and in terms of our own physiologic blood circulation. While we're on the subject of drugs, there's a nationwide shortage of Estratest, which is a conjugated estrogen and testosterone drug. And I've had some very difficult times the last few weeks trying to find resources for patients. One of my patients actually wrote me that there is a generic called Methyltest out there made by a company called Amneal. So if you're having trouble finding Estratest, you might go looking for which pharmacy might have this particular generic. I don't know what their supply chain is like, but it's good to know that there is at least one alternative for people. I've been trying to get it compounded, but that's no easy thing to do. And also, it isn't necessarily covered by insurance. So some patients are having a real problem with their supply chain. And we're going to go now to our first caller, Dennis in Santa Cruz. Hello, Dennis, and welcome to the program.
Hey, Don.
Hey there.
Dr. Don, I guess. I have a problem with a finger, index finger, actually.
Go ahead.
And it may have come from using a trackpad on a computer too much.
Uh-huh.
It seems to be the exact opposite of a trigger finger. That is to say that a trigger finger usually binds in a fist-like position.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
true.
You can't open it.
Right.
Mine instead, if I sleep, let's say, with my hand in a palm position open, when I wake up in the morning, I can't bend the finger, the index finger.
It's stuck.
It's stuck. I can do it very painfully and slowly. And if I actually take my left hand, it's a right hand, if I take the left hand and I bend the finger down, it doesn't hurt to do that, but then I can't lift it up again.
So essentially you take it from an extended freeze into a flexed freeze at that point.
If I do that manually with the other hand, if I...
What do you usually do then? If
usually, I with a lot of pain, I just slowly, slowly bend it down, and it finally gets into a place where then the whole rest of the day, as long as I'm using it, it doesn't hurt.
So let me get this straight, though. If you manually, taking your left hand like a puppet, mm-hmm. bend your finger into a flexed position, that doesn't hurt.
That doesn't hurt to do that.
But once you've done it, you're stuck.
Then I'm stuck. I can't lift it. Then it's like a trigger finger.
Wow, that's an interesting phenomenon. And let me just ask, in terms of swelling or redness, the joints aren't enlarged? It isn't swollen
None
like
at all.
A sausage? And the pain that you feel, is it in the shaft of the finger or is it in the hinges, in the joints?
Well, it seems to be in the shaft. I always thought it was in the shaft until I've done some recent research and all. And I'm starting to think that it may be the lower flexor tendon, I guess.
Yes.
Which is on the palm side of the finger.
Yeah. Based on what you say, let's go back and just cover trigger finger for the audience. Now, mm-hmm. if you have a system of pulleys that are running through these little stays, which are rings around the bone, and the pulleys run underneath these rings. Mm-hmm. And if the tendon, which is the rope of the pulley, got a bump on it, it can bind as it passes under the rings. At night, we don't move our hands, so our hands tend to swell a little bit. And if the tolerances are poor to start with, because you've got a nodule on the tendon, then that little bit of swelling can be enough to cause the nodule to bind and not slip under the ring. Mm-hmm. And that's a classic trigger finger. Most people sleep with their hands curled. And so their problem is waking up with the finger frozen in a curled position, or they'll be working during the day and they'll get it down and they won't be able to straighten it out. They'll have to do that manually. Even though yours is extension, if you're making a habit of, if you actually sleep in extension, which is unusual with the hand flat, you probably are triggering at night just like other people do, but in your case, you're triggering out at extension. The fact that you experience pain when you do it yourself, using the muscles, probably indicates that, as opposed to when you do it passively, you're not tugging on the tendon when you do it passively. But when you do it manually, in other words, when you do it voluntarily, mm-hmm. with your right hand using muscle power, you are yanking on the tendon and it's hurting, it's sending a pain signal. So I think it is a trigger phenomenon. Since you're localizing the pain down at the proximal joint, right near the knuckle, that's most likely where the nodule is. So an experienced hand doctor, which would be in our community here, a plastic surgeon, should be able to localize where the nodule is. And it's a matter of careful palpation. You can usually find the nodule and throw a little cortisone directly in there. The cortisone shrinks it, reduces the inflammation, and that may be enough to take care of the problem permanently. I'll usually, if I can feel a nodule, I'll inject it myself, but I often don't find them where the plastic surgeons do. And it works maybe 50% of the time, maybe 30%, somewhere in there. Certainly not all the time. I'll generally give it 2 tries. And if it's not successful, then refer the individual for definitive surgical management where the nodule is shaved down. And that usually takes care of the problem.
And how long does it take to recover?
Good question. Not long. If you're talking about the steroid injection, not long at all. If you have to have the surgery, I think you're splinted for about a week, something like that.
That's all.
Yeah, it's not too bad. Wow. And you might be able to find a device that would help keep it from coming back. I want to point out there's some really interesting input devices that are used by people with various disabilities. And one of them is a device where you have a little camera, you know, just a little camera that comes with most computers. And you wear a bindi, kind of a little dot on your forehead. And you can just mouse with the forehead. You just point the bindi at the screen, and you have a little dot. The camera sees where you're pointing your head. And there's also, of course, more sophisticated devices that focus on your pupil, and they basically put the pointer where your pupil is looking on the screen. Mm-hmm. Those are fairly available technologies. They'll run most software. Most computers are set up to download the drivers and run them. And it's a way to relieve the hand. So if you did that, set that up, you would obviously have an easier time with your recovery.
Interesting. I have one question for you.
Yeah.
I've been reading about pain and how it can be associated with myofascial trigger points someplace else instead of in the finger, that it might be up on the arm.
Honey, if you are working with computers on a regular basis enough to get anything going on in your hand, you are going to have trigger points in your shoulders and neck. It's just a dead guarantee. And everybody who sits in a computer-type position, unless they're very careful not to, will develop some myofascial trigger points in their head and neck. If you press on tender points in the trapezius and just have someone take about a one-inch dowel is good. Some of those little massage devices that you can pick up that are for self-massage will work.
Little round ball thing.
Little round ball thing, about an inch across. Mm-hmm. Small drawer pull is what it looks like. Just push really hard. It's called ischemic pressure, so enough to blanch the skin. And it's kind of press until it hurts a little. Hold on for about 60 seconds. And if it's a referred pain from a myofascial trigger point, it'll sort of shimmer into existence in your hand the way that, you know, in a mirage situation, something shimmers into distance and resolves in the distance, the pain will kind of shimmer into existence, usually somewhere between 30 and 60 seconds.
Wow.
And so then you'll know, okay, there is a referral point. Mm-hmm. And you'll discover that if you push on those, that you probably do have some referrals. Generally, they go into the humerus, the triceps area, or the forearm near the elbow. Mm-hmm. Rare for them to go all the way out into the hand, but that certainly can happen.
Okay, cool. I just wondered if that was a possibility.
I don't think so, because those referral points are not going to happen with actuating the finger.
No.
So I don't think so for this pain, but yes, indeed, there is referred pain with that patterning.
Now, is there anything I could do myself for these nodules that you're talking about?
Yeah.
Like
you're not going to like it, though. You have to push back from the keyboard and walk around and move your shoulders and twist your neck, and you have to do it about every 20 minutes and get lost.
I meant more with the finger itself, the problem with my trigger finger, as it were.
Well, you know, just unloading it by stopping mousing with that hand for, give it a 3 or 4 week moratorium.
Uh-huh.
And I would ice, too. When I do mouse, I would ice that area. Okay. Maybe you could even
Well, there's
put
no
your...
swelling, so what
yes,
would the ice
there
do?
Is swelling. There might, but it's so minuscule, you're not seeing it.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, because it's the hand, uh-huh. Well, another thing that might work would be topical non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, like something called Asper Cream, which is really cheap. It's like salicylic acid gel or cream that you rub in. And because the tissues are so, there's not a lot of fat, it's a short distance, you might be able to diffuse enough aspirin down there to actually get an anti-inflammatory effect. And which would also reduce shrinkage without going so far as to inject with a steroid.
Now, would something like Motrin or something, would that be an anti-inflammatory? Would that help?
It could be enough. Typical anti-inflammatory doses of Motrin are like, depending on body weight, 600 milligrams three times a day.
Wow.
So the over-the-counter dose is a pain control dose. It's not really an anti-inflammatory dose.
Uh-huh.
So you'd need to take a lot. It could work. But you'd also be putting yourself at risk for more side effects.
Yeah, right.
Whereas, you know, treat locally, right?
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Good ideas.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Before we go to our next caller, just a little food for thought here. This is from a Washington Post article this week by Rob Stein. There's a project called the Dartmouth Atlas Project, and they go around and look at things across the country looking for variation. And boy, did they strike it rich in the subject of end-of-life care. So here's the scoop. They looked at 250,000 Medicare patients who died in the 4 years between 2003 and 2007. They were all over 65, Medicare patients by definition. And they looked to see who died in the hospital, who died at home. The range is just amazing. So 46.7% of people who died in Manhattan who were over 65 died in the hospital. 18% of those had a feeding tube or got CPR. Meanwhile, out in Mason City, Iowa, 70%, and these are all, by the way, cancer patients. So these are people where this is terminal cancer, death is expected. 7% of these cancer patients in Mason City, Iowa, died in the hospital, 46.7% in Manhattan. And I mentioned 18% on feeding tubes in Manhattan, 4% in Minneapolis. Now, I have to say, I think feeding tubes should be used in cancer care early, while a person is still getting their chemotherapy, while there's still a chance of cure. The better you feed that person, the better they're going to do with their chemo. And one of the things we don't do is feed our cancer patients properly. So I'm not saying feeding tubes in cancer are bad, but when someone is terminal and you know it, feeding tubes are debatable. And certainly it sounds like Manhattan needs more hospices and it may be more awareness on the part of doctors that over 3/4 of people with terminal cancer, when asked, express a desire to die at home and not in the hospital. So why that very strong opinion is not being heeded has to do with cultural factors and other things that we really need as a society to address. But this level of variation is almost a priori evidence that somebody somewhere is doing something wrong, because I just don't think people vary that much culturally between Iowa and Manhattan. Let's go to Robert in SoCal. Hello, Robert. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
Your articulate blend of academic and medical wisdom is pretty darn impressive. I thank you for it.
Well, thank you very much.
When the temperature drops in October, I find I am revisited by something that bites and creates a little itchy welt bed bump. And these critters must have some engineering DNA, because they'll do their biting or whatever they're doing to create the little itchy bumps symmetrically. And one side of the body matches the other side.
Okay, anything like that ain't a bug bite. Okay, because they don't home in that way. But
okay.
It's a very interesting phenomenon. Let's deconstruct it a little bit and see if we can figure it out.
Okay.
So it's always seasonal. And
yes.
Around October.
November, November.
October, November. And when does it stop?
Well, let me just back up. And last night was particularly cool, and they returned in force, or it returned in force, or whatever happened, came back.
And so, back to the question, when does it stop?
Well, I don't really know when it stops, but I know when it starts, when it gets cool. And then during the warm season, I do not experience it.
All right. So we'll say that this next spring, you'll try to pay attention. Now, next question. Once you get one of these red bumps, how long do they last?
They can last a week. They start to shrink a little bit and become a little more firm. And sometimes they itch a lot the first few days. A little alcohol helps, but they're not unbearable.
Okay. And what parts of your body are most commonly affected? Let me frame it this way. Is it from the knees and the elbows? Is it out towards the fingers and toes, or is it in towards the belly button?
It's primarily more inward, although I'll get one on my shoulder, on the outside of my shoulder, whether trapezius, whatever, and sometimes on my lower legs. But mostly it's the soft inner parts.
So torso, okay. What about under the arms and in the groin creases?
Armpits, a little bit, and inner thighs, yes.
Okay. So top of the list is actually fungal. That's weird for it to be happening in the winter, but the distribution definitely makes me think yeast, candida, topical fungal thing. So other questions, what else changes? Clothing change, do you start wearing? I'm going to run a whole list here. You don't have to answer yes or no. But, you know, do you start wearing different kinds of clothing? Is there something in the detergent or the fabric softener that's in contact with your skin that isn't typically worn in the summer? Is it a difference in terms of diet? Is this a manifestation of a food sensitivity? Unlikely, that tends to distribute more widely on the body and not conform to the creases. Things like scabies will occur in those areas, but scabies also really likes the inside of the elbow, the creases of the elbow, the creases of the wrists. So,
no, I'm sure it's not. I'm sure this isn't scabies.
Okay, just throwing that out.
Well, the clothing question, it usually occurs when I'm wearing pajamas or, you know, warmer clothes for sleeping.
Okay. What I think I would do next is a punch biopsy on a new lesion and see whether it's infiltrated with eosinophils, which would be an allergic type reaction and would point you in one direction. You'd also want to stain that for yeast forms and see if you come across any fungi or hyphae. Dermatologic questions are pretty difficult to answer definitively on a radio program for obvious reasons, but the symmetry and the reproducibility of the locations here, with the exception of scabies, really doesn't sound like bug bites, bed bugs, any kind of bugs. They're just more of a random walk on your body.
And the idea of bed bugs has not occurred to me, but the idea of some kind of critter does. And I'll change all the bedding and vacuum the mattress and just do all kinds of stuff, and it goes away for a few days. And I'm thinking, oh, that's what it is. It's the critters. And then they come back. Then it reoccurs.
Yeah, I gotcha. It's going to be interesting. If it were obvious, you would have figured it out by now. I wish I could help more.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Susan in Monterey. Hello, Susan. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
I talked to you, I guess it was a couple of months ago, about my PADD, peripheral artery problem.
Yes.
And you suggested walking, and I tried that. However, my energy level is just unfortunately not up to it. I go out and walk, and then I'm just wiped out for a couple of days.
Hmm.
I was wondering what you think about massage therapy, if massage therapy might, or perhaps even acupuncture, might be equally effective in that regard.
You know, Susan, I don't remember clinically if you had any kind of imaging studies to look at where your blockage was and how severe it was.
Well, I'm still in treatment. They assigned me, and I went did a battery of tests in the past few weeks, and of course I'm going to be seeing my doctor on the 30th, but I just thought I would...
Did we talk about Hawthorn as a...
Pardon me?
Did we talk about Hawthorn as an herbal agent to increase blood flow to the extremities? I would suggest it now. I don't know if I suggested it when I spoke to you
what
before.
What did you say again, please?
H-A-W-T-H-O-R-N-E.
Oh, yes. I think you said something about that, and I did take some of that. And then you had another something, I think it started with a K. I don't have my notes in front of me.
Right. To answer your question, the concept with blockage is that you create, by walking, you create a need for oxygen, and that feeds back to cause new blood vessels called collateral blood vessels to form. So I'm sorry to hear your energy level isn't up to walking. It's generally, the idea is you walk until it hurts, and then you rest, and then you walk until it hurts, and you try to do that multiple times per day to get that upregulation of the angiogenesis signaling to occur. Angiogenesis means new blood vessels. So when you get your results from the doctor, if you have like one or two areas that are very narrow, not long areas, but short areas of blockage, then it may make sense to have those opened up surgically. It's not really surgery. They thread a balloon up across the blood vessel and blow it up. And so it's kind of a stent, not a bypass. So it's a pretty low level, it's invasive, but not dangerous invasive kind of intervention. If you have a long area where there's a lot of disturbance for a long period of time that is longer than the balloon, then trying this progressive walking therapy, maybe doing it in a physical therapy setting where you're on a treadmill or something that you can hold onto the handles and just work your legs, that might be a little bit easier for you, a little bit less tiring.
But I was going to ask that.
If you're too tired to walk, then you can't do this therapy, obviously. But then that's awfully tired to be too tired to walk. So that
makes me worry
what else is wrong with you, because that shouldn't be the case.
I probably could work on a stationary bike, or maybe, like you said, treadmill. Would that
be? Yes, that might be a better idea.
Well, when I go to my doctor, I'll bring this up and see what she says. Appreciate your...
There's a cardiac rehab unit that I know Dominican has one. There's probably one down in your area as well, and they have all of the equipment. And I think Medicare would cover cardiac rehab for someone with documented peripheral artery disease.
Yeah, well, I went up to Stanford, and that's where it was first diagnosed.
Right.
And
But you don't want to go up there three times a week
can't
for therapy.
Go up there
You got to find a local place.
Exactly, but I appreciate what you're saying. So, in other words, that would be an option to bring up to my doctor.
Yes, and without knowing your specific clinical results, I can't tell you whether it's a good option.
I understand.
Have a good day, and good luck
to you. Thank
you. Feel free to call back later when you have more information.
I will do that. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And as promised, I'm going to take a few minutes and talk about cholera, our science lesson this week, and something that's been very, very much in the news lately because of Haiti and the epidemic that they're having. There have been almost 1,000 people killed since the beginning of this epidemic. And worse, there's a political backlash because the strain of cholera that's circulating in Haiti is a Southeast Asian strain, and it's been linked to possibly having come into the country with the UN troops from Southeast Asia who are currently there helping out, as the UN has had a presence in Haiti since 2004 as a peacekeeping presence, but obviously they're also an occupying army, and what we have now is a backlash against the occupying army. Whether this is the source is open to question, and honestly, it doesn't really matter. Cholera used to be a problem all over the world, but with the improvement in public sanitation measures in major urban areas in Europe and the United States, it's pretty much gone away. In fact, the last cholera epidemic in the United States was like 1910 or something like that. The reason that cholera is such a nasty disease is the speed with which it causes prostration. The organism Vibrio cholerae is just a bacteria. And of course, there's lots of bacterial diarrheas out there. Turista, caused by toxigenic E. coli being one of the common ones. And the very, very nasty E. coli, the one that the omega 157, which has caused a lot of deaths in the last few years in foodborne epidemics in the United States. You hear that word toxigenic E. coli. Toxins are very nasty when they get into the intestinal tract and tend to produce a lot of morbidity. In the case of cholera, this bacteria, but few of them manage to make it through a normal human stomach because stomach acid is an important protection. Therefore, if you're on a proton pump inhibitor, you're at increased risk for cholera. Not that that matters, because you're not going to get a big enough dose in the United States or Europe for that to be a problem. But if you're in Haiti, definitely lay off the Prilosec. Once the bacteria gets through the stomach, it implants itself on the wall of the small intestine. It actually produces a toxin which binds to the intestinal epithelial wall. It binds to a receptor, and it's like knock, ding, dong, knocking at the door of the cell. The cell then, thinking that this is a vitamin, absorbs the toxin, takes it into itself. Once it gets into itself, it actually binds with a protein that's present in the cytoplasm. And this opens up a little box in the toxin that causes it to produce a bunch of cyclic AMP. Now, this is a very potent signaling protein. In the case of the human intestinal cell, one of the things that this results in is the cell pumping lots and lots of chloride out into the lumen. In other words, from the inside of the cell, the chloride ions are pumped out into the lumen. That causes sodium not to be able to get into the cells. So essentially what you've done is you've paralyzed the recycling of fluid, because our bodies, our intestines, dump fluid in and then suck it back out. And in the case of cholera, the large amounts of chloride ion result in a very rapid loss of body water. And we're talking about someone with cholera putting out 10 liters of watery diarrhea a day. 10 liters is more than your blood volume, folks. So a person with cholera can dehydrate so rapidly that they literally shrivel up and die before your eyes. It's easily treated with IV fluids, but in a situation like Haiti, you run through your IV fluids pretty darn quick. Oral rehydration solutions work well, and the UN has these little packets that you mix with clean water. Oops, where are you going to get that? In a country that's deforested, it's really hard to boil water because you can't get fuel to boil water. And so chemical methods and filtering methods, which are good, are being used. But because of the political backlash, a lot of people in Haiti aren't even trusting their water sources. So it's really a terrible situation. The bottom line about cholera is its speed. It's a poop-to-mouth disease, and it's gotten from contaminated water. If you wash your hands after helping someone with cholera, if you're a nurse or a doctor, and you just use good hygiene, you are fairly safe from catching cholera. Human-to-human transmission is very rare. It's getting the poop chain and the water chain separated and well separated that's the key way to managing this kind of an epidemic. Let's go to Mai in Santa Cruz. Hello, did I get your name right, Mai?
Right, I know you, Dr. Dawn, from Sculpture.
Oh, hello, yes.
Hi, it's nice to talk to you. I just happened to turn on in the middle of the program when the fellow was talking about the skin bumps that he gets, and I didn't hear it all thoroughly, but I'm wondering if one of the problems might be, since it's seasonal, just the dryness in the house when you've got the heat on, because I do tend to get particular rash in the winter months when it's dry. So just something I thought I would throw in to the mix.
Well, thank you for the suggestion. Typically, the dryness rashes are more common on the distal extremities, because those are the areas where we tend to get drier. So people will, the underarms and the groin creases are not areas that dry out as much in the winter as the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
So
I do tend to get this on the torso, under my breasts.
Under the breasts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
just passing that along. I do have a prescription cream that seems to help.
And this is Myra the dancer, right?
Yes, used to be dancer,
This Myra, folks, I have to tell you, is completely responsible for me getting involved in Sculpture in the first place. She dragged me, these many years, off to Tom Wolver's class, the Corralitos Arts Center, and made me wear a blindfold and play with clay. And Myra, you changed my life. Thank you.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm so happy to hear that. You know, I didn't remember that I was
the one. You've got to come and try this. You'll love it. Famous last words. One kiln, thousands of dollars later in clay and art lessons, and big lumps of vitrified earth on my on my front yard to show for it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful pieces that you did. Well, good. I'm glad I started you on this addiction. I just wanted, I reached for the cream that I use here just to tell you it's fluocinonide. I have no idea whether it would be helpful in his case.
It's a cortisone cream.
Yeah.
Yeah, the other thing, by the way, on while we're on the subject of acupuncture, this is a Chinese medicine thing, that lung which controls skin, so that lung meridian, which is important for the integrity of your skin, can be treated. So things that tonify the lung, herbs that moisten lung, would be good things to be using in the fall and winter. And I'm not a Chinese herbalist, but hopefully one is listening and will call in and give us some suggestions about what remedies might be helpful for people who get this kind of a cold weather, dry weather rash.
Well, let's hope so.
Let's see who's listening.
But it, mine does tend to go away very quickly when I treat it. But Don, I'm delighted to hear that that I was the one that got you started in clay. I hope you're still doing it when you have time.
I am.
Good. Me too.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Let's go to Billy in Santa Cruz. Hello, Billy. Welcome to the program.
Oh, Dr. Don.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question that I hope you can clear up. I'm really confused about Medicare Advantage plans. When I called your office not too long ago, and I was told that you were taking new patients, and I said, well, my health insurer is Anthem Blue Cross Freedom Blue Plan. It's a PPO. And they said, that's fine. And then when I, as an aside, I said, yeah, that is a Medicare Advantage plan. And then immediately the answer changed. Well, no, I'm sorry. She can't accept any more Medicare patients. And right. I was stymied, and I was just wondering, is there something that I don't know about? There obviously something I don't know about how Medicare reimburses Anthem Blue Cross.
This is a political and business issue, so really not appropriate for this program, but I'm going to break the rule and talk about it anyway because I think it's important. Most of the doctors in this town lose money on Medicare,
right.
Straight Medicare. And when you have a PPO, whether they call it Medicare Advantage or whatever else they call it, it's a Medicare supplementary policy. That generally doesn't help, at least here, because Medicare reimbursement is 22% less than it is in San Jose due to our rural characteristics.
Right, I'm aware of that.
And if you're paying a living wage in Santa Cruz County, you're paying more than you're paying in San Jose, by the way. The numbers just don't work. You actually lose money, and most of us cross-subsidize our medical practices with our younger patients. So
right.
We get enough more. Now, hear me out. You get enough more from Blue Cross Advantage for a patient under 65. The difference in reimbursement is huge. So even though you said you're this insurance, you weren't. You were a different insurance, but you didn't realize that because the words are the same to you. But they're definitely not the same to us.
Mm-hmm.
So I've reached the point where I am turning away business because I lose money on that business. And without radically restructuring either my practice and cutting my staffing, I can't make a living seeing Medicare patients.
Couldn't. Do you get reimbursed the same with the plan that I mentioned, the Anthem Blue Cross plan, Freedom Blue plan, as you would get reimbursed directly with from Medicare
if
I were just a straight Medicare patient?
Yes, you get reimbursed differently. I don't.
I don't get reimbursed.
Well, yes, you do, because you get stuff covered that you would otherwise pay for out of pocket, and you're just not seeing it as a reimbursement.
I just don't have to file the form.
You just aren't seeing it that way. But essentially, when a person is in a Medicare HMO, and there's only one left in town, I'm not going to advertise for them because I think that does cross the line here on this program. But there is one available. One of them is closing down. There's one available right now. That one actually reimburses doctors at a higher margin, and primary care doctors actually get paid decently by the Medicare HMO. And we're doing a lot of the preventative stuff that they cover, so they kick us more money because that's our job, is the preventative stuff. Whereas Medicare essentially pays me to do biopsies. If I see a patient, spend half an hour with them talking about their prediabetes, their high blood pressure, and then I do one skin biopsy. The half an hour I spent for the blood pressure gets me reimbursed at about roughly $45, whereas the 5 minutes I spent doing the skin biopsy gets me paid twice that.
And is any of that going to be corrected at all in the new health plan that's phasing in?
You know, if I had any idea what pieces of the new health plan will phase in, or in which pieces will be torpedoed
right.
in Congress, and which pieces will be held up in the courts for a decade because of, I don't know, that lawsuit that the attorney generals are putting in, there's just no telling what will happen. But in terms of relief for primary care doctors, it's going to be a long time coming. And quite honestly, I don't want to sound bitter, but by the time it arrives, we're going to have lost our primary care infrastructure in this country, and we're going to spend 15 or 20 years, at least 10 years, rebuilding it, because we will have dissipated it. We will have destroyed that, and we will be stuck with too many high-priced specialists and a whole bunch of mid-level providers, and we won't have any primary care doctors anymore, because in about 10 years, I'm going to be thinking about getting out of Dodge.
What about single-payer coming up in California?
I don't know what that means, single-payer coming up in California.
Twice the legislature has passed basically a single-payer health.
And twice the governor has vetoed it.
Right.
So if it comes up again and Jerry Brown passes it, then we'll see how many lawsuits that generates and how long that takes to actually be implemented.
Mm-hmm.
I can't hold my breath. I have to.
Right,
make, I
understand.
You know, I got to make payroll every month. To all those people out there who are Medicare patients who are experiencing this kind of discrimination, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry I can't subsidize your health care with my failing business. But what you need to do is get on the horn and push for change, push through AARP, push through your other things. Because if we don't support the primary care base, it's going away. And it's not being supported right now.
So you don't know much about, it's called California One Care.
I don't know if I'll ever see it. I know enough about it, but I'm not holding my breath. It would be better, but I don't know that I'll ever see it.
Well, I'm very supportive of the California One Care movement. Thank you much.
Bye-bye. Let's talk to Sarah in Live Oak. Hello, Sarah, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I went to my dentist and had some molar work done, and I had a Novocaine injection in the roof of my mouth. So painful. But I lived through that, and now it's been 5 days later, and on that spot in the roof of my mouth, feels like the tissue is sloughing away. It's not extremely painful. It's just...
Does it feel rough when you rub it with your tongue compared to the surrounding tissue? Yeah, okay. So you have inflammation of the mucosa. It could be a reaction to, a little reaction to the local, or it may be actually an ischemic reaction. In other words, they usually use epinephrine when they do injections. And if some of that got out to the very surface of the skin, could have actually caused a little damage, and so you're sloughing off damaged tissue, kind of the way you would have a blister. You know, if you burned yourself, you'd have a blister, and the blister would peel.
That seems like maybe what happened, yeah.
Yeah, and that's maybe a little bit too much, or it diffused a little close to the surface. I'm not going to rag on your dentist as having done a bad job. When you stick needles into people, sometimes the needles don't go deep enough, or they go too deep, and the person has a complication. This is not a big complication. Mouth heals really quickly, and it's not hurting you a lot, so it should get better.
Thank you. I'll stop worrying.
Stop worrying.
Yeah.
You can kind of swish a little aloe vera around your mouth before eating chilies, and that'll probably help coat it. You know, chilies or lemon juice or vinegar might sting a little bit.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And we're going now to Jane in Carmel.
Thank you.
Hi.
I wanted to ask you about herpes, living and loving with herpes. I've been dating somebody, and I found out after several months that he has herpes, and I wanted to get some guidance from you about that.
Okay, so this is genital herpes.
Yes.
All right. Well, first thing I do in this situation is I get the person in question tested. In other words, the seronegative partner. So that means the person that we assume doesn't have herpes, which would be you in this context. And we make sure that you aren't already immune, because you may have already developed antibodies to herpes virus type 2, which is genital herpes, as a result of exposure with this partner or with a previous partner and not have had an outbreak.
Okay.
So let's assume that you have antibodies, then, you know, you're both basically infected or have been exposed, and if you are, and you may actually have some immunity. So at this point, what we would say is have fun. Don't worry, treat, if you're both positive, you know, you really don't have that much more to share, except good times. And if you're negative, if you don't have antibodies and you're trying to not get antibodies, the best way, and there's no foolproof way, but the best way is for your partner to be on suppressive doses of anti-herpes medication. So a drug like Zovirax at 400 milligrams, that's acyclovir, 400 milligrams twice a day would be what we call a suppressive dose, and it would tend to prevent the person who's positive from shedding any virus, because unfortunately we know that people can shed virus without actually having an outbreak. So even if he hasn't had an outbreak for years, it's possible, theoretically and scientifically at least, that he occasionally has virus coming off the surface of his penis or the surface of his testicles. And potentially that could infect you, even without his having lesions. However, the volume of virus that's shed is much greater during the time that a person has active lesions. So obviously you refrain from intercourse at those times.
Okay.
So specific questions. If I haven't, because I hear in your voice, I haven't answered your specific question.
Oh, one question that I have regarding this is that he said that he has had oral sex with women previously, and they did not catch the herpes. And I'm wondering if that's something that's possible in this situation, or if that's also something I should be cautious with.
Okay, well, oral sex, obviously, you're talking about he's the receiver of the oral sex, and you're concerned in getting the herpes from him into your mouth.
Yes.
Unlikely. It's rare to find anyone with herpes simplex 2 in their mouth. The virus really, it's sort of herpes 1 lives above the belly button and herpes 2 lives below the belly button, and they seem to have carved out their respective niches fairly well, at least as far as humans are concerned. So it's unusual for someone to get oral herpes. Nothing's impossible, but it's quite rare. So that, so far as that goes, that's true. And there's also that it stands to reason that he doesn't shed type 2 genital tropic herpes from his mouth, more than likely, either.
Oh, no, that's, well, what I was wondering was if I can get genital herpes from him by giving him oral sex.
Essentially, no. Because how does it get from your mouth onto your genitals? It's not going to get there through your bloodstream. It has to get there physically.
Oh, direct contact.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's not like the herpes gets into your bloodstream and then goes, oh, migrate to the genitals. That's not how it works.
Okay. Oh, you know, none of the herpes websites talk about that at all.
You know, it's a good question, and we'll have to feed back to them that they should talk about that, won't we?
Maybe so, yeah. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. I had an off-air question. How many units of vitamin D do I recommend as a supplement? The answer is whatever it takes to get you to a level of 25-hydroxy vitamin D of 35 or better in the bloodstream. And in some people, that's 1,000 units, and in some people, that's 5,000 units. So it's treat to the blood level. Don't just randomly take a number. Let's go to Laura in Santa Cruz. Hello, Laura, and we have just a couple minutes.
Hi, Dr. Dunn. I have a question about commercial deodorant and the safety of it. I've tried so many deodorants, and I'm a public high school teacher, so I really need it to work. And I'm looking on the cosmeticdatabase.com, and it says that the ones that I have tried that actually work are a hazard of 4, moderate hazard, and I'm just wondering what that means and how you would feel about that on a daily basis.
Okay, so the database, the consumer products database you're looking at, what's the source of that? I mean, there's so many.
Oh, it's from your resources.
Okay, it's the links from my resources. All right, fine. Then that tells me what that hazard reading means. Okay, so when you look at the list, and that's a really good consumer health and environmental safety consumer website, when you look at that list, the ones that it says are more safe, just you've used and they haven't worked for you.
Right, there are also natural ones don't.
Right. Yeah, so basically you need the aluminum is what it amounts to. And in order not to have too much perspiration, and the aluminum has some implications. There's concerns that having extra aluminum in your body can be toxic.
Right.
The old Alzheimer's thing has kind of been debunked.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that a small amount of antiperspirant used, you know, judiciously, maybe you could try using it every other day or mm-hmm. alternating sides to keep your dose down. Try to find something that's paraben free.
Okay.
And, you know, the old deodorants, which are not antiperspirants, you know, are worth a try.
Okay, I don't mind the sweating. It's just the odor.
Yeah, but okay. the old deodorants, they have no aluminum because they're not antiperspirants.
Okay.
And those are much, much safer, and you might be able to get by with that.
Okay.
Combination
of that.
And do
you think it matters, like, to try not to get it directly after shaving?
Yes.
Okay.
Particularly with the antiperspirants. Uh-huh. Because you don't want it to penetrate into the bloodstream. You don't want to pick up a blood level of aluminum, which can redistribute anywhere.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
No, nobody needs to shave their armpits every day.
No.
Dr. Don says.
Right. No, I agree.
Okay. Bye-bye. Well, we've come to the end of another hour. And what an amazing variety of questions and answers it's been. I hope you'll join me next week for more of the same. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.